Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why some arts organizations are dealing with lots of financial questions as they look to their futures.
And how the new tariffs on tomatoes could help Florida but hurt Arizona. But first, the Trump administration recently cut around $207 million from the National Endowment for the Arts. That means grants that had already been awarded to theaters and theater companies went away. Congress is also considering further cuts to arts funding. An appropriations bill in a House committee recommends 35% cuts to both the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Among the theaters affected by the canceling of NEA grants is Child's Play, based in Tempe. It had gotten a $25,000 grant to put on a show called J-Sonic and the Unknown, which is set to open the company's season in September. But my next guest says other programs could also be affected in the not-too-distant future, including programs both in and after school, as well as research into the efficacy of using creative drama in the classroom. Dwayne Hartford is the artistic director at Child's Play. He joins me to talk more about what's happening there. And Dwayne, it sounds like uncertainty is kind of the word to describe this. You're certain you've lost the $25,000, but the rest of it, there could be more cuts. But if there are, you don't know how much and you don't know when they would happen.
Exactly. And so it's kind of hard to run a business. It's kind of hard to hire teachers and then turn around and tell them that you don't have work for them. There's no way to plan anything. We have a budget for the year. We're just starting our new fiscal year, and everything's just a big question mark.
So how do you try to do that? How do you try to plan for that many unknowns?
I'm laughing because you can't. You have to certainly have contingencies, which we do, and we're looking at and we're developing. But we also, we're not going to be in the not-for-profit arts business without being optimists. And so we have to believe that somehow the right thing will happen eventually. And yes, we're one company and there are many other companies, but the schools, I can't imagine what it must be like for the schools and going into this and not knowing what they're going to be able to offer.
What kinds of conversations have you been having with schools about not only what they can do, but what you might be able to do to help them in terms of, you know, after school care or even having them come to shows?
It's all up in the air right now. Of course, a lot of this has happened over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of schools are out still. So, but we're saying to each other, we want to do this. We want this to happen. And let's hope it will. And at the same time, we can't commit to anything.
Are there other sources of revenue that you can look to? I mean, I assume you don't want to be charging hundreds of dollars for your tickets, you know, to make up for the lost revenue. So are there other places you can look to make at least some of this up?
Yes and no. Certainly, we can go out into the philanthropy field and ask individual donors, foundations for additional help. And we certainly are leaning on our friends and we have some very generous donors, but it's an unsure time all around. And for a lot of foundations and individuals, they're thinking about the social safety net. So they're holding back a little bit on arts funding. It's a tricky time. So we're going to be there as long as we can be and hope for the best and hope that we'll come out the other side. We will. I know we will. It's just going to be an interesting time. It continues to be interesting times until then.
Well, and is it possible that as you emerge from the other side, whatever that might look like, that Child's Play might just look different than it does now?
Absolutely. And we have lots of conversations about that and talk about where we might be going and what does the community need. We'll figure it out. We'll be here, but we might look differently. We might be smaller. I hope not, but we'll
you never know, right?
You don't know. And it's strange times.
Well, is there a chance that other things that Child's Play does could also be impacted? I mean, you obviously have classes and academies and other, you know, summer camps, things like that. Like, might you have to shift money around to keep, for example, the after-school programs going or the theater in the school programs? Like, do you have to at some point make a determination, okay, it's kind of like picking your favorite child as a parent, right? Like, this program, we love them all, but this program maybe has more of an impact, so we got to make sure this one gets funded. And that means maybe this one doesn't.
Possibly. Those are all questions that we'll be asking. Our academy programs do very well. Our after-school programs and our residency programs, which are the way we do it, it's separate from our academy, they're big. We employ a lot of teaching artists, and we hope that that continues. It's important. It's great work, and it's really making a huge impact. But sure, if the money's not there, if the schools can't pay for it, it will go away.
So you mentioned the show Jay Sonic and the Unknown, which is set to, as you say, debut not that long from now, just, you know, more than a month.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still on track? Like, what stage of production were you in when you had this money taken away?
We were well into the design process. The actors aren't on contract yet,
mm-hmm.
but we've cast them. And all the designers and the director, choreographer, and all that. So we're committed to doing this show. Jay Sonic and the Unknown is part of a national project called the BIPOC Superheroes Project. All of us felt very strongly that this needed to happen. So we're going forward. We're having to look for money elsewhere. We're having to, you know, push money around and do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But it's moving forward. This is a partnership with Phoenix College, and we didn't want to back away from that partnership. And so it's happening. It just might hurt a little bit more, but that's okay.
You mentioned that to do what you do, you have to be an optimist. What gives you optimism right now that things at Child's Play will be okay?
Because I believe we're needed. I believe that what we do for young people and for families and for schools is vital. Theater's been around for 3,000 years because it serves a purpose. And when you bring people together, an audience and performers together live in one room or outside in one area, and those actors are telling a story to the audience, something happens there that you can't replicate in a movie theater or anywhere else. It is that basic human need to tell stories. It's how we learn. It's how we understand each other. Of course, empathy is such a big thing. And it's part of what we do for young people, help them to understand the concept of empathy. They understand the idea of looking at a situation from another point of view. Also, at the same time, seeing your story on stage and saying, hey, I understand that. That's me. And that pride that comes with that. So I know there will always be theater. What it looks like and how we get there are up in the air. But I'm optimistic that we'll be here. With coming up in 2 years will be our 50th anniversary. And I have no reason not to think that Child's Play won't be here for 50 more.
All right, fair enough. That is Dwayne Hartford, Artistic Director at Child's Play Theater Company. Dwayne, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Deadpool is not just a superhero in the movies. Here in Arizona, it's the grim reality we are barreling toward on one of our largest reservoirs, Lake Powell. The Bureau of Reclamation says water levels at Lake Powell are looking bad. So bad that they could drop too low to generate hydropower as soon as next year. That could have major implications for millions of people in the West in terms of power and water in the not-so-distant future. KUNC's Alex Hager has been covering it all, and he joins us now with more. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming on. So begin for us with just where Lake Powell is sitting right now. Like, how bad is bad?
Right now, it is about 30% full. That is obviously not great for water supply, but you know, it hasn't been that much more full for a while. We are seeing this reservoir at near record low levels after more than 20 years of drought, and that's sort of become the new normal up there. The thing that really raises the hairs on the back of water managers around the West, the thing that really puts them on edge, is when we start to see that hydropower in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. They have found ways to cope with the lower water levels, at least in the short term, but when it gets too low to dip, to dip below the intake for those hydropower generators, then they start to get worried.
Okay. So we are looking at Deadpool, which means, of course, there could not be enough, there might not be enough water to generate hydropower. What are the implications of that? Like, if we're talking about power for millions of people in the West across lots of states, what does that look like?
It's a little bit less to do with the actual ability to generate hydropower and more to do with the fact that it lays bare that we do not have a good system for managing this reservoir, given the amount of water that's in it today. When water dips too low to turn those hydropower generators, we do have a fix for it. There is a big system of upstream reservoirs. So the dam where these generators are, it's in Page, Arizona, just south of the Utah border in the very far northern part of the state. We can send water from other reservoirs further north in Wyoming and Colorado and Utah to help fill up that reservoir, prop it up, and make sure that we don't lose the ability to generate hydropower. But that's kind of seen as an emergency band-aid. It is seen as something that we are not going to be able to do forever. And so when water managers enter this kind of emergency mode, it raises calls for, hey, we need a new long-term system to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
There are implications for water supply too, right?
Yeah, it's a sign that, we do not have as much as we used to. Lake Powell, they often refer to it, you know, people in Western Water refer to it as the savings account for the Colorado River. And the fact that it is so low is a sign that our savings are dwindling. That is felt all across the region. It makes people antsy about the laws that we have to govern who gets how much water, but it also makes people prepare and try to institute some resilience. You see that all around the valley, in Phoenix and so many of its neighboring cities. There are efforts to kind of figure out how to live with less, programs to incentivize people to take out their thirsty lawns, spending millions or even billions of dollars building facilities to recycle wastewater. People are seeing the writing on the wall. You know, people in charge of cities and in charge of farms in a lot of cases are seeing the writing on the wall that there is not going to be enough water to go around in the future. And they are trying to institute systems that will help them cope with that when those days do arrive.
Right. It makes it all more dire. So let's talk about those long-term plans, right? Policymakers are in the middle of negotiations now to figure out long-term plans for shrinking Colorado River supply. We have lots of stakeholders involved in this. And last, I think we talked, negotiations were at something of a standoff. Where do they stand now, Alex?
Well, it's been a little bit of good news and a little bit of bad news. There was something that, you know, I had seen some experts refer to as a glimmer of hope about a month ago when we saw the earliest makings of a plan, basically showing that the seven states that had long been locked in disagreement for well over a year, you know, were starting to coalesce around a plan to share water based on how much is actually in the river and not based on antiquated laws that aren't kind of true to today's climate reality. In the time since then, though, we've seen them get really hung up again. They could agree in concept to say we should come up with a plan that's based on how much water in the river and, you know, reduce the total amount that we're trying to share and then figure out this, you know, what size everyone's slice of that pie is going to be.
Yeah.
But figuring out what size everyone's slice of that pie is going to be is really difficult, because these are negotiations that are sitting on the shoulders of more than 100 years of rivalry between states that have long been going at it about who has the moral right to use more water and how that should be codified into law. And they are still really entrenched in some of those same old tensions in a way that is making it hard for them to implement, you know, ideas that will actually allow the West to share a river with less water in it.
Right. So history playing a role here. They have a 2026 deadline to come up with something, or the federal government essentially steps in. It's looking like we might not make that deadline.
It really all depends. You know, in the past, water leaders have waited for an outside force to come in and levy some pressure. I have talked to some of these top negotiators who basically say, look, we don't really expect to figure this out amongst ourselves. We kind of need a you know, another party to come in and say, here are the consequences if you don't.
Right.
And so, you know, it's possible that in the remaining months here, we could see the federal government all of a sudden get really aggressive and say, we are going to implement this specific plan if you do not put your heads together and come up with something, states. And the states might say, well, now the consequences are laid bare in front of us, and we should really do something about it.
Should really do something about
but
it.
But there's a lot. It depends. It's very contingent on a lot of different variables, like the federal government. We don't know exactly how they will act. We don't know how quickly they will act. We don't know how much time they necessarily need to get this set in stone. Because even though their deadline is, you know, kind of middle to late 2026, there's a lot of paperwork you have to get done.
Right.
You know, you got to do a lot of studies to make sure that this will not harm the system in some other ways.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there. KUNC's Alex Hager joining us with the latest on the Colorado River. Thank you, Alex, as always, for coming on. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Lauren.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what do you do with little scraps like receipts, wrappers, and ticket stubs when they hold memories? We'll hear how a local artist built community through junk journaling. But first,
local Republican and Democratic leaders alike are up in arms about new 17% fees imposed on imported tomatoes. Yes, they are about to get more expensive on your grocery store shelves, but the move could also hit Arizona jobs pretty hard. Our next guest reports the move by the Trump administration could imperil $8.3 billion of economic activity and about 50,000 jobs here and in Texas, where the tomato import business is robust. Joanna Allhands is a columnist for the Arizona Republic's opinion pages, and she joins editorial page editor Elvia Diaz this morning to talk more about it. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Joanna. This is a move that Florida is happy about, right? Because they grow more fresh tomatoes there than in any other state. And the idea here, right, is to boost domestic tomato growers. But this, you say, could really hurt Arizona. Tell us how.
Yeah. What's interesting about what's happened is that even though if this works as expected and Florida gets more tomato production, really their industry, even though it's the largest in the U.S., it pales in the size of the import industry that is in Arizona and Texas. Mm-hmm. So really, if you're boosting one state, it really kind of is coming at the expense of the others who have people who work in the importing business who are bringing in tomatoes from Mexico to feed the American people.
Right. It's interesting. And we could also see prices go up for tomatoes. And that isn't just on grocery store shelves, right? Like that could have ripple effects in, you know, things that you're buying at a restaurant or ordering salsa. Like tomatoes are in so many things.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, if you're ordering a pizza, right, the sauce is going to have tomatoes. It's not just the fresh tomatoes that you're buying in a carton in the store, although that certainly is a huge part of this. And that's the part where now is going to be subject to fees. But I think what's also interesting about what's happened is that Mexico has invested in a lot of greenhouse technology to be able to grow tomatoes year round. And these greenhouses that they have are really technologically advanced, so they can really pump out high yields of things, and especially the specialty tomatoes that we like, the grape tomatoes, the cherry tomatoes that people like to buy, mm-hmm. those are grown really well in greenhouses. Florida hasn't invested in that technology. Most of what they grow are still sort of the traditional old school kind of slicing tomatoes. They kind of, you know, pick them while they're still green and then put them in these places and then use gas to ripen them. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole different product. And I don't honestly know how they're going to be able to keep pace with that production should we not be able to really get that produce from Mexico anymore, or if it becomes just too expensive because of the fees. Hmm.
Let me turn to you, Elvia, and ask a question about tariffs in general here, and this tariff in particular. Like, we've seen this play out so many times since the Trump administration took office. This time we're seeing both Senator Mark Kelly on the left and Representative Andy Biggs on the right, right? Like, this is a bipartisan opposition to this move. Do you think that changes things?
No, unfortunately, it doesn't, but they are correct, you know, both Republicans and Democrats in this case, to be united in this situation. So it sounds great to just say America first and, you know, grow the tomatoes here. But Joanna explained that it's at the expense of Arizona and Texas. You know, Florida is a Republican state, it's a MAGA state. So Trump is catering to them in this case by going back to Arizona. So we journalists normally talk about, and politicians too, how this is going to hit the consumers. And that's the most important thing, right? So I don't think consumers are feeling that yet of any tariffs, you know, really hurting in their wallet. They will, but they haven't. So I don't think that's resonating so much. But when you look at Arizona with the tomatoes, we're talking about $2.6 billion worth of tomatoes that cross the border annually through the Nogales port of entry. That's a huge, huge amount of money. And that really means more than 100 companies importing, distributing, warehousing, and transporting the tomato just in Santa Cruz County. Mm-hmm. And I believe I was reading a study from ASU that put the loss of jobs up to 22,000, 23,000 just in Arizona because of the tariffs. So this is real. I mean, imagine what's going to happen to all those 100 companies, and they're relatively small, you know, distributing companies with a few employees. That's going to be very disruptive. There's going to be a lot of people without jobs. And if I have a job and you have a job, and then you say, oh, well, we're going to be fine. But it's not just about us. It's a state economy that is at risk, that is going to be truly affected. And now we know that, yes, it is going into effect. So not surprising at all that Republicans and Democrats are united here in Arizona on this matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. Joanna, I wonder if you think about that in your coverage of tariffs, right? Like, when does the rubber kind of hit the road? As Elvia pointed out, like, people aren't really feeling this in their pocketbooks quite yet. Does that have to happen for the general public to say these things are not a good idea for our state in this way or that way?
Yeah, I think, I mean, case in point, I just bought tomatoes this weekend, and my little carton of, you know, snacking tomatoes that I bought was like $2.50, and I had a, you know, 60-cent coupon. So it hasn't hit anybody yet, because some of the stuff, it just takes time, you know. I mean, it's going to be the crop 30 days from now or so on. I mean, that is going to be the one where you're going to start to feel the increase of the fees. And it depends on, is the American public, are they willing to pay an extra dollar or two? Does that really hit them? Or is it, you know, sort of like what happened with eggs, where suddenly it was like, oh my gosh, we have $6, $10 a dozen eggs. And then people said, whoa, 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 whoa. And then started speaking up to politicians. And then all this stuff, you know, started coming out. So it depends on how much of a sticker shock, I guess, we're willing to take. I would hope that people would see it and say, you know what? Hey, what's happening? Even if it doesn't hit their pocketbooks, though, if enough people, you know, to Elvia's point, if there's 20,000 people in Arizona who could possibly be out of a job, especially in Santa Cruz County, that's a huge industry for them that just could get decimated. That really has impacts that go far beyond whether you're going to buy cherry tomatoes at a store.
We're talking about 124 million or so in state revenues and state tax to the revenues. And so money going into the state coffers, and guess where the money goes? Everywhere. And this is coming at a time when revenues are down, when the federal government is taking a lot of programs that funnel and finance programs in Arizona, you know, from education, from healthcare, from you name it. So if you take more money out of the general fund, that affects all of us who live in Arizona, and it does have a ripple effect. Again, the people, the middle class and the wealthy are fine. They're going to be fine. Mm-hmm. But then it's the rest of the population that are going to feel this. And ultimately, it is not good for the state. So no, I believe the people who are paying attention understand this. The general population is too busy with whatever is happening out of Washington and the latest scandal to pay attention to how this is going to affect us.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it there for now. Editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, Elvia Diaz, joined by columnist Joanna Allhands this morning. Thank you both for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
This week is shaping up to be a big one for climate news, with a pair of significant announcements expected, one tomorrow and one on Wednesday. With me for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, what are we expecting to happen here?
Yeah, I mean, the first one tomorrow, as you say, that according to the United Nations, its Secretary General Antonio Guterres is going to give a major speech tomorrow where we're told he'll set out a compelling case for why a so-called renewables revolution is now inevitable, in his words, and he'll outline the benefits that a global transition away from fossil fuels, what that will bring to economies, energy security, and just generally people's well-being. The Secretary General's special address, titled A Moment of Opportunity, Supercharging the New Energy Era, is a follow-up from his Moment of Truth speech last year. And the announcement is expected to be accompanied by a technical report with evidence based in there to provide details how moving from fossil fuels to clear energy shows clear economic opportunities. Now, it comes at an important time. You have the pivotal COP30 climate conference. Aren't they all pivotal? That's what we're told, at least. But this next one is happening in Brazil in November. And it's a key moment because countries are expected to submit new, more ambitious national climate pledges. So we got to watch out for that one. Then on Wednesday, we go to The Hague in the Netherlands. The top court, the United Nations top court, the International Court of Justice in The Hague, is going to issue a non-binding opinion on countries' legal obligation to fight climate change, a decision that is likely to affect climate change-driven litigation around the world. Now, according to the climate correspondence I've read, this ruling is potentially the most authoritative and influential legal statement yet on states' obligations to address climate change. This announcement is expected to address whether large states contributing the most to greenhouse gas emissions should be liable for damage caused to small island nations. There is no international jurisdiction, but what can happen is that the ruling by the ICJ can be used to instigate domestic and other international proceedings which do have binding and enforcement powers. So, two very big announcements on the climate to look out for this week.
Interesting. Pete, let's go now to China, where a China-EU summit is scheduled to take place later this week in Beijing. It marks the 50th anniversary of diplomatic relations between the two, but it also comes at a time of strained relations over issues like trade and the war in Ukraine. So what is likely to be on the agenda here?
Yeah, as you say, it begins all in Beijing, and it's on Thursday when European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen and her delegation arrive in Beijing following a visit to Tokyo the capital of Japan the previous day. However, as you say, it comes amid trade disputes and Beijing's continuing support for Russia. And because of this, the EU team are likely to face a frostier reception in China than the one that they will have had in Japan, I'd say. Now, you mentioned the two sides will be commemorating 50 years of diplomatic ties. And that type of anniversary ordinarily would be a chance for Beijing to showcase and for both sides to sort of, you know, showcase its partnership, I guess. Yet, before we've even got to this summit, which, as I said, begins on Thursday, we've already got plenty of indication that this is likely to be a pretty cold affair between both sides. Now, first thing to note, the summit's being held in Beijing, even though it was Brussels' turn to host the rotating event. Also, according to the European Union, the meeting will last only one day. It was supposed to be 2 days. And then on top of that, I've also read reports that the Chinese President Xi Jinping is not going to attend. Now, I can't completely confirm that, but there are reports that he's not going to attend. I think you could say that's a snub. And considering, you know, the high-level delegation that's coming from the EU, read into that what you will. Then on Friday, the EU announced a new package of sanctions aimed at restricting Russia's military, but it also had the effect of hitting a number of Chinese companies and financial institutions. Two Chinese banks and five companies based in China were affected by the sanctions, and it's the first time that Chinese banks have been added to the European sanctions list since Russia's invasion of Ukraine back in 2022. According to the EU, they were listed for providing cryptocurrency services that were frustrating the purpose of sanctions. Today, Beijing strongly criticised those measures. A spokesman for the Commerce Ministry in Beijing said the sanctions have a serious negative impact on China-EU economic and trade relations. So all of that going on before the two sides meet on Thursday, I think there's a lot to watch out for when they do eventually get round the table to see if they can overcome some of these difficulties.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. So Pete, let's stick in China and another big summit taking place there later this week when the World Artificial Intelligence Conference begins on Saturday in Shanghai. What's the significance of this one?
Yeah, another big, important global summit going on in China. But then in the background, you have these, you know, geopolitical tensions. The World Artificial Intelligence Conference, the WAIC, it's being billed as one of the most influential AI events within the global tech, science and industry ecosystem, as the blurb says. And the theme for this year's conference, according to organizers, is Global Solidarity in the AI Era. Now, that's an interesting title, given, as I've said, these current geopolitical tensions, some of which we've just touched on before with the EU-China summit. Now, again, according to the press blurb, the event aims to balance a showcase of Chinese AI innovation with discussions on international cooperation and governance. However, Mark, I think it's fair to say that this summit is taking place in the context of an escalating AI race with the US and Europe. And while China's official theme is global solidarity, you could look at some of the things that have been going on in the run-up to this, such as, of course, we'll know that the US has restricted or imposed strict export controls on advanced semiconductors and superchips. Some of that's been loosened in recent weeks. I believe NVIDIA last week was given the okay by Washington to start selling some of these chips back to China. But, you know, given some of the things I've mentioned about the EU previously and this restriction from Washington, yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen quite how much cooperation will happen. What I will say is that China is definitely making some dramatic advancements in AI, and it will be worth looking out, seeing what kind of things coming out, whether it be, you know, some sort of robots, you know, doing some things that we haven't seen before. There's a lot of geopolitical tensions that will have a lot going on in the background, but at the same time, there might be some interesting videos coming out of some new technology that's being released soon.
Yeah, it should be interesting to see. All right, that is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Always a pleasure being with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Artist and U of A professor David Taylor has been observing the U.S.-Mexico border for more than 20 years. He sums up the future of the border infrastructure in one word: proliferation. He describes the border system that has emerged since 9/11 as, quote, a 1,900-mile-long service economy built and maintained largely by private contractors. It's an arm race, he says, likening the ballooning industry to a Cold War economy.
For a recent project called Complex, Taylor focused specifically on ICE detention centers, the sprawling, nondescript warehouse-like structures where migrants are sent for grueling indefinite stays. These structures stand in stark contrast to the vast expanse of mountains and desert that often surround them. And Taylor's work combines aerial drone footage, landscape photography, and audio recordings featuring the testimony of people who have spent time in these facilities. That includes Arizona's Eloy Detention Center, where detainees have alleged a wide range of mistreatment from ICE agents. Taylor spoke with our co-host Sam Dingman more about the project.
It looks like an industrial park, more or less, but an industrial park ringed by double perimeter fence, surveillance cameras out in the desert adjacent to agricultural fields. You wouldn't notice it unless you knew what you were looking for as you drove by. Once you recognized sort of typology of these facilities, they become easier to pick out, but they're fairly nondescript. They're ultimately nestle in alongside Amazon warehouses and logistics facilities of that sort.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you brought up Amazon warehouses as the example there, because one of the things that I know is interesting to you about this project is talking about what the architectural design elements of these facilities say about the values behind them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are really, in many ways, a sort of apex expression of the neoliberal mindset, right? The sort of privatization and commodification of everything. And so these are ultimately warehouses for people, and the individuals who occupy the bed space are the raw material of the industry.
Talk a little bit more, if you could, about, you know, you used the word industry, and one of the other elements of this project that I know is interesting to you is the involvement of private industry in generating these facilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all for-profit facilities. Of course, there are still state and federal run jails, prisons, but in the moment of mandatory minimum sentencing, there was a sort of move toward having private prisons, right? Through all sorts of different legislation and policy changes, right? So effectively, incarcerating people became an industry. The way that I come to it is around immigrant detention. The project that I've been pursuing really intersects with immigrant detention, but it belies the larger system insofar as these are contract facilities for hire. And so an entity decides that they need to satisfy the imperative of incarcerating whatever group it might be, and they contract with these companies to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars. And it might be inmates from Hawaii, it might be women in immigrant detention. The populations are sort of always turning over, and the contracts move with whatever the contracting agency, you know, has deemed a priority.
Yeah. Can I ask you a little bit about the experience of interacting with the work? Because there's still images, but then you also have kind of slow-moving drone videos of these facilities, and the drone cameras are moving very slowly, either high up in the air, giving us like an aerial view that conveys the expanse of the buildings that you were alluding to when you were describing them earlier, but then you also have some where the camera's moving very slowly on the ground through the aisles between the structures. Mm-hmm. And there is this silence to it. The grandeur and significance and the sprawl of the structures contrasted with the silence is really striking. Mm-hmm. And then in one of these videos, you also have audio from people who were incarcerated in these facilities talking about these very horrific experiences that they had.
Lo que viví en La Palma, 8 meses de tortura psicológica.
Un infierno viviendo 6 meses preso.
Pero hay personas que llevan 1 año.
And the lack of ambient sound or natural sound also contrasted with the intensely personal experience conveyed in the voices of the people interviewed was mm-hmm. jarring.
It's gratifying to hear that you read it in that way. That's the intent. Those voices, and I should make a shout to the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project and the really important work that they do in pro bono representation of people who are in asylum proceedings. They facilitated the connection mm-hmm. With all of the folks that you are hearing. And those voices are reflecting on, in particular, the experience of being in detention as the COVID pandemic broke out.
Yeah.
And anything other than their voices just felt like a hollow choice to me. I mean, there's a drama in hearing the emotion of people's sort of uninflected recollection of what they experienced. I assemble them in a way that you are sort of led through the kind of quotidian experience of being in the facilities through to really the most fraught moments of the pandemic and people's palpable desperation that can be heard in their voice. And I think people, when you read people, really good journalism and scholarship around these issues, we're seeing not rapists and criminals and gang, you know, members, but people fleeing climate insecurity, people fleeing economic insecurity, people fleeing political instability. I met 2 young men from Sudan near the border last year. One of the young men introduced them as being from Sudan, and he said, quote, "I don't know if you know, but there's a civil war in our country. Our homes are gone."
Yeah. Well, David Taylor is a professor and associate dean at the University of Arizona College of Fine Arts and is the artist behind this project we've been discussing, which is called Complex. David, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time and attention.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Leslie Tiger has a thing for keeping stuff. Receipts, ticket stubs, wrappers, junk mail, you know, stuff.
I've always collected scraps. Ever since I was little, I have boxes and boxes of random stuff, you know, that people might look at and they would call it junk. And to me, they were, you know, my little treasures.
But she never knew what to do with all of these little pieces of life until the artist who goes by the name Tiger Teeth started junk journaling.
Junk journaling is already a thing. And I think in some senses it's been a thing for a very long time, but people haven't given it a name. Scrapbooking is, you know, kind of the mother, I think, of junk journaling. So, of course, we all know there's been scrapbooking for a long time. And it was kind of people who did it more casually and with things that you wouldn't usually use whenever you're doing a scrapbook.
Right.
People get scared of doing scrapbooking because it's so, it feels very intense. For example, not to drag my mom, but she always talks about how she still has not finished my baby book because she's stressed to do it. She's
yeah.
like, I have all this stuff, but it's just so hard to put it together. So I think that it takes that stress out of it. And people are just like, oh, these are some pretty napkins. These are some, you know, beautiful things that I have. And I'm just going to sort of start putting them into a page. Some people like to journal along with it, put photos. People have all these different styles. Some of them are very messy, and some of those are the most interesting ones.
Now, Tiger runs a junk journal club almost every week at a gallery space downtown where like-minded collectors come together to junk journal. But as she told me when she came into our studios recently, it all started as sort of a happy accident.
So I am an artist. So I started out, you know, vending sort of my art. I had, you know, prints and totes and, you know, postcards and all of those little things. And I just had like some scraps because I was making stickers. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, these are so, they're so pretty. They're just like pretty colors. I don't know what to do with them. So I'm going to put them in a container. I'll bring them to a market and I'll put free scraps. I put an envelope next to it and was like, whatever. If people want them, they can. If it gets people closer to my booth to chat with me and look at my stuff, that's a bonus.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a hit. Like everybody who came over, not everybody, but the girls who get it. So the ones who get it came over and were like, oh my gosh, scraps. And they would be packing these little pretty pieces of paper into their own envelopes. And all of them would say, oh my gosh, I really want to get into junk journaling, or, oh, I do junk journaling, or I'm going to go do this with my friend soon.
Yeah.
And I just saw like a spark and an interest and an excitement that I didn't know other people had in this kind of thing.
So you've got a book here of some of the examples of how you have junk journaled.
I do.
And you brought a bunch of stuff to show us how this comes together.
I did.
Okay. And we have our producer here as well, Amber Victoria Singer, who is into this and wants to try it, brought her own pile of junk, for lack of a better phrase.
And I love what she's doing over there.
Okay. So what kinds of things, first of all, do you both have? Describe this for us.
I've brought with me some scraps from a date I went on last week. I have the receipt from where we ate, Chibo, and then I have a Joe's Italian Ice receipt.
Mm-hmm.
I have a ticket to Shrek at Pollock Cinemas. I plan good dates.
That's yes. A good date.
I have a ginger candy wrapper from a ginger candy I was eating at their house after. I've stolen from Leslie a jack and a 10 of hearts.
Yeah.
So it was on July 10th.
Okay. Oh, wow, man.
See,
so it's a memory keeper in a way, but it's also just super random, right?
A little bit. Like it can be random. I have a ton of pages that are really random.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage people to do random unless if something really specifically calls to you.
Yeah.
Like I have here, this one that I'm looking at is I have a couple of spreads from a trip that I recently took to Moab with my boyfriend. And here are some of the things that I have here. I have Pepto-Bismol because I ended up getting food poisoning halfway to Utah. That's awesome. So I have, you know, my Pepto-Bismol there to remember it. I have some printed out photos from the trip. You know, I have a postcard, a little label of a beer, picture of our campsite. We had like some dice that we opened. So I have the packaging from the dice, like a hot dog tray, I guess, not used. I asked them if they had two and they're like, I'm like, yeah, you can have two, you crazy lady. I don't know what you want it for, but okay. Some from our champagne, I have, you know, this is one of my favorite things to junk journal with is the foil from champagne bottles. Here's the netting and a photo of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just all kinds of stuff.
So you mix
that
in photos, but it's very textured, right? Yes. Like, I don't know, does this feel tangible to you in a way that maybe like a digital version of this would not?
Oh, absolutely. And don't get me started. I think that I am a big fan of the digital world, but I'm also a big, big fan of analog crafting.
Mm.
And I think that making things with your hand is really the antidote to doom scrolling, which we're all doing right now. People need to be touching things with their hands. They need to be doing things. And whenever you're doing it with a group of people and you're getting people together, it's really an act of resistance against anybody who's seeking to control us, because there's a number of people who benefit from stealing our attention. And I'll tell you, it's not us.
Yeah. That's really interesting. So it sounds like you got a lot of very intense reactions from people when you started doing this on a organized basis.
Shocking.
Like what? Tell us.
I couldn't have imagined it. whenever I started doing it, because whenever I did the free scraps, I saw that people were interested. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I was like, oh, well, it would be cool if people made a little page, you know, at my booth. I set up one table. It was 4 feet. And the very first people who came, it was these two girls who actually still come to Junk Journal Club today. Shout out Nina and Joy. They were the first ones. And they had kind of said, they were like, oh, I didn't know how much I needed this. Mm-hmm. And I remember that sort of struck something in me, because then all day people would come, and it's another one of those things. If you get it, you get it.
Yeah.
A lot of people look and they just weren't interested, but if they got it, they got it. And people would say, this is the most creative thing I've ever done. There were people who got emotional. And then I have different people who come to Junk Journal Club, and I think that they really see it as this very safe place where they can come and they get to like unwind and do things with their hands with other creative people. And sometimes people do get emotional, and there's a release that they didn't know that they needed. It's a way for them to be more present with the things in their lives that they collect, the things that they hold on to, and to even kind of think about why.
Yeah. So Amber, you're over here doing your first page of a junk journal. What does this feel like? What do you like about it?
I feel like I'm a paper hoarder. I have like a pile of wristbands from shows that I go to.
Make a whole page.
And I just like, I hold on to receipts, and because I like journal, and I always say that sometimes I glue things into my journal and I just write around them, but mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I do end up just having a pile of trash because I'm sentimental and a bit of a hoarder and I can't throw away receipts from special days.
Yes.
So it sounds like it's a good way to keep a record. And there's a nostalgia factor and a memory factor, but it also sounds like this is sort of therapeutic to people.
I think that it is. And I think it's a way for people to hold on to these things and get this released. Yeah, I think it's just really good for people.
Yeah. All right. Well, getting the word out.
Yeah.
That is Leslie Tiger, a.k.a. Tiger Teeth, artist and founder and host of the Junk Journal Club, along with our producer, Amber Victoria Singer. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.